this morning getting rid of a plane and going back to California. But unfortunately, none of the planes are flying this morning.
How are you?
Okay, so at the end of the last lecture, we had decided that this formula that I wrote here is a good representation of at least the first stage of the formation of event shapes in E plus E minus annihilation to hadrons. And what I was doing, what I was trying to do at the end of the last lecture, but I guess we'll do it now, is to talk about some more detailed aspect of this formula, in particular the physics that leads to these singularities when x goes to 1 and x goes to 2. And okay, well, what usually happens in quantum field theory is that whenever there's a singularity in an expression, it means there's some physics that you actually need to understand. And so what I'd like to do is to do a computation of the singular terms in that expression, which it turns out is going to be very illuminating. So let's first try and understand why this singularity is there. Where does it come from? So let's think again about the diagram we're computing. So now I'm going to label this diagram a little differently. Let's have the quark come out this way and give that momentum k. I'm going to give the gluon momentum q, and I'm going to call this intermediate off-shell momentum p. Okay, we're working at high energy. So we're working in the approximation where the quarks are massless, and the gluons, being gauge bosons of a Young-Mills theory, are massless in the same, for the same reason that the photon is massless. So I have two massless particles arising from an emission from this also essentially massless line. Now, there's some important kinematics to do with that. The fermion propagator is p slash over p squared. So we need to know what's in the denominator. P squared is k plus q squared, which is equal to 2k q, k dot q, which is equal to 2ek eq. Remember, these are massless particles, times 1 minus cosine theta kq. So this is a very important expression. It says that the denominator of this Feynman diagram is 0, not only when the photon or the quark is soft, but also if they're hard and collinear. So there's a what we call a collinear singularity. If the original quark splits to two approximately collinear species, k and q, and basically splits up its longitudinal momentum between these. So I'm going to take this to have fraction z and this to have fraction 1 minus z of the longitudinal momentum of the original quark. For any z and 1 minus z, as long as these vectors are collinear, we're in a singularity of the diagram. And so that gives a certain amount of phase space for things to happen. In particular, it's going to make it very likely that such splittings will occur, and the splittings become more and more likely as the two particles become more and more collinear. Yes?
Why, when you've written p squared equals 2kq, that doesn't force k or q to be 0 because p is also massless?
No, p is off shell. P is off shell. So p occurs in the denominator of this Feynman propagator. But when the denominator is 0, the whole Feynman diagram blows up. That's the point. OK? So what I'd like to do now is to compute the singular term in this Feynman diagram. So, and maybe I should say one more thing before I do that, last time I talked about the thrust, which is the maximum over n of the sum over particles I of n dot p divided by the sum of the momenta. So I used this as an event shape variable, and I told you it was better than some other ones that you could use. And one of the reasons that I liked it was that we could compare the physics at the hadron level and at the quark parton level. So another definition of an event variable that you might use is this one. Maybe it's even more obvious, where you basically take all the momenta of particles in the event, you form a tensor, and you dot that thing with n, and then you maximize this over n. So this quantity, actually not exactly this quantity, but a quantity defined similar to this, is called the sphericity. So now we see that thrust is actually better than sphericity, already at the level of this lowest order diagram. Because if I take a quark and I split it up into two collinear pieces like this, this is something that's overwhelmingly likely to happen even in the weak coupling stage of QCD. It doesn't affect this diagram, because here you just get z plus 1 minus z, and they're going in the same direction. But it affects this, because you get z squared plus 1 minus z squared, which is not equal to 1. And so a quantity for an event-shaped variable which is not affected by splittings like this is called infrared safe. And it's only for such event-shaped variables that you can actually compute their values in perturbation theory and expect that to have some relation to what you actually measure in the experiments. So with modeling, you can actually do something with sphericity, but for thrust, you pretty much get the right answer just at the level of perturbative QCD. Okay, so let's now continue this computation of this singular term in this Feynman diagram. So now I'm going to have to do the kinematics a little more carefully. So let's consider Q and K to be going roughly in the 3 direction with a small transverse momentum so that we can make this denominator p squared finite. So let me write ze kt 0 ze. And for k, I'll write 1 minus ze minus kt 0 1 minus ze. And p should be the sum of these vectors. So I wanted p to be e 0, 0, 0. Now, there's a little nicety here that we have to attend to. Q and k are on mass shell, and p is off shell. So I need a little correction here. Okay. So now this vector will be on mass shell at the level of kt squared, to the accuracy of kt squared. If I square this, I'll get a term minus kt squared. Here I'll get plus kt squared. So the effect of kt will vanish in the mass shell condition. So this now satisfies q squared is equal to 0 up to terms of order kt squared. So maybe I should say including terms of order kt squared. Similarly, we can do that here. Okay. Now, for p, momentum is conserved. So what we have here must be the sum of these two terms, namely kt squared over 2e times 1 over z plus 1 over 1 minus z is 1 over z times 1 minus z. And so p is off shell, but we can calculate p squared. it's e squared minus e squared, and then there's something from this, so you get kt squared over z times 1 minus z. So please notice, when you go to the soft limit, either z goes to 0 or 1 minus z goes to 0, this goes on shell, and we'll get an additional kind of singularity from soft photon emission. But in the collinear limit, this is a number controlled whose off-shellness is controlled by the kt, by the transverse momentum of the splitting. Okay, well, now we have a strategy for computing this Feynman diagram. Let me recall that this propagator, to the extent that it's almost on mass shell, can be written as u of p, u bar of p, divided by p squared. So now I can start factorizing this Feynman diagram. What it is the lowest order diagram capped by this u bar of p times I over p squared times u of p, and then there's this emission diagram. And so now what I'd like to do is to compute the emission diagram explicitly. That's, as we'll see, pretty straightforward. So, okay, well now, the emission diagram, the matrix element is I, G, one of these group theory factors, U bar of K, gamma dot epsilon of Q, U of P. And if I, everything's massless, so I might as well just recognize that all the u's, if I take u to be left-handed, it's just a two-component spinner up here and zeros down here. And then this is IG TA u dagger of k sigma bar dot epsilon of q u of p, where this is the left-handed part of the spinner. And now, this is, okay, now we can just tabulate these things. So u of p, something going in the 3 direction, is the square root of 2e times 0, 1. So for the 4-component spinner, it would be 0, 1, 0, 0, as it was in last week's lecture. U of k, there's a 1 minus z here. And then there's one more thing. K is tilted a little in the negative direction in the 1-3 plane. So if you're careful about the sign, there's a kt over 2 times 1 minus z times e. So that's the angle through which it's rotated. And there's a plus sign here, if you're careful about the sign. And then for epsilon, there are two choices for epsilon. So for the fermion, helicity is conserved. And so if this is a left-handed fermion, that must also be a left-handed fermion. For the gluon, that could be either left-handed or right-handed, so we have to consider both choices. The left-handed polarization vector is this. The right-handed polarization vector is this. And then the photon is rotated slightly in the other direction. And again, if you're careful about the signs, there's kt over ze with a minus sign here. And finally, what appears in this expression is epsilon star, because we're producing the boson, so this sign changes. Okay, now we're all set. Now you can readily compute sigma dot epsilon L star is equal to this matrix 1 over the square root of 2. The minus sign is up here. There's a 2 here. And sigma bar dot epsilon r is 1 over root 2, the same structure. The 2 is down here. Okay. And so now we just have to take the matrix element of those matrices between this and this, and we're all set. So, now we're almost done. So, let me do first the left-handed quark producing a right-handed gluon with a left-handed quark. So I'll use this matrix. Now, please notice that when I act on U of P, this is 0, 1. So it's only this column that multiplies the 1. And that entry there is 0. So the only thing we're going to get is this entry acting on the 1 and overlapping with the 1 here. And so if I just collect all the factors, there's an IGTA 2E, the square root of 1 minus Z. There's the 1 over square root of 2 from here. And then that matrix element gives me a KT over ZE. And now if I have QL going to GL QL, I get almost the same thing. Can you tell the difference between a 2 and a Z in my handwriting? The Z are the guys with the slashes through them. So there's the same term as we had before. And there's another term where I take this one, I take this matrix element, so I go upstairs, and I overlap with this guy. And the combination of these things is KT over Z times 1 minus Z times Z. So there's an extra factor of 1 minus z actually in this expression. And now things begin to cancel. The e's cancel. The 2 cancels part of the square root of 2. And so we now end up with the following expressions. The matrix element squared is equal to, let's do the G left case first. There's a G squared. TATA is an SU3 group theory factor. Let me just tell you, it's equal to 4/3. There's a square root of 2, so there's a 2 in here. There's a 1 minus Z in the numerator, but there's a 1 minus Z squared in the denominator. So there's z squared, 1 minus z. There's a kt squared. And I think we've now got everything. And turning pages too fast. And for the right-handed case, there's an extra factor. This factor is not here. So there's an extra factor of 1 minus z squared in the numerator. And of course, you can't tell a left-handed gluon from a right-handed gluon, so we'd better add the two contributions. OK. Well, now we're making excellent progress. That formula let me preserve over here. Now we're making excellent progress, because now, basically, we can almost do the whole computation of this diagram. So once again, there's a lowest order diagram. Then there's this propagator, and then there's this splitting amplitude that we've just calculated. So the whole integral actually involves three body phase space. It involves the integral over this p bar over here. It involves the integral over k, and it involves the integral over q. But let's rearrange this in the following way. We'll leave the p bar integral there. For the k integral, k is a shift of p, so I can write that as the p integral. Now, I replaced p by k here, so I need a factor of 1 minus z. Now, the only thing that's left is the q integral. So the q integral I'd like to write in the following way. First of all, the longitudinal part of the q integral is dz times e. That's the longitudinal momentum of q. And then I have a q in the denominator, so there's a 2 pi cubed times 2ze in the denominator. The transverse part of the q integral I'd just like to write as 2 pi kt dkt. And now we can just kind of clean this up. So that plus that is two-body phase space for the original process. What we're left with is an integral over z, an integral over kt with an extra kt, a factor of z times 1 minus z, and let's see, an extra 8 pi squared. Okay? Now, this thing we can push into the computation of this cross section. So the lowest order cross section goes there. And now we just take these matrix elements and we integrate them up with this phase space expression. Oh, and one more thing. We need the this thing comes squared in the denominator. So we have the integral dz, the integral dkt times kt, 1 over z times 1 minus z. There's an 8 pi squared. This thing comes squared in the denominator. And then these matrix elements. Z squared, 1 minus z, kt squared. Oh, look at how nicely this is working. Yes?
In your first expression for the 3-bit body phase space, should it be d3p bar divided by 2?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Right, but whatever that is, it goes straight into here without modification.
Okay.
So now please notice all the 1 minus z's cancel. The z's mainly cancel, but one is left over. The kt's will cancel down to a 1 over kt. And there's one more thing I forgot, which is the 1 plus 1 minus z squared, which is 1 plus 1 minus z squared here. And so now, finally, we get the following expression. The cross-section for some process plus a quark splitting to a gluon and a quark almost collinearly is the original cross-section times the integral dkt over kt times the integral dz times g squared combines with this. Oh, there was, and the 2 and the 4, everything comes, sorry, the 2 and the 8 pi come together to make alpha s, 4 thirds alpha s, 1 plus 1 minus z squared over z. And that's a very simple expression, very easy to understand. So now you can kind of see what's going on. The quark starts emitting gluons. The gluons are sprayed out in a logarithmic pattern in KT. Also, there's a sharing of the two momenta. Maybe I should do it this way. There's a sharing of the two momenta in the longitudinal direction. And that's determined by this factor here. It's basically a 1 minus 1 over z, but then for soft gluons, there's an extra contribution. Actually, why is this suppressed at for hard gluons? Because this is the case where the gluon flips its helicity. And so the soft gluon can be any helicity, but the hard gluon should carry the angular momentum of the quark. So you can easily understand why that is suppressed when z goes to 1. Yes?
Did you understand what you meant?
That hard and soft.
Oh, hard and soft here means the gluon, the large z is a hard gluon. The z goes to 0 is a soft gluon. The z is the fraction of the original quark momentum that the gluon carries. Okay, so this is a very, and then this 1 over z here is the usual singularity for soft photons in QCD that you already saw in QED. So a very, very simple expression. This function is often given a name. I'm going to give it a name. P of Q goes to G of Z. So it's called the Altarelli-Farisi splitting function. So basically, it gives you the probability for the momentum sharing in the longitudinal direction when you have one of these covenier splittings. Yes?
The reason that we can split our phase space integral to this pi2 and regular one, is it just because RP is almost on shell?
That's exactly right. So there's not much difference between a quark moving in this direction and a quark and a gluon that are moving almost parallel to each other. And so the phase space for this object is almost the same as the phase space for this. And then I only have to integrate over the internal degrees of freedom of this object, which is what I've done.
So why wouldn't we have the gluon coming out with a very large amount of momentum in a totally different?
Oh, we could.
Okay.
We could. But if the gluon came out with a very large amount of momentum, these approximations wouldn't be valid.
Yeah. So
then instead of a small denominator, I'd get a large denominator. And so that effect would not be enhanced in the way that this one is. I mean, to put it another way, this effect is order alpha x, but it also multiplies the logarithm of a large range in momentum transfer. And then the effects you're talking about are order alpha s, and they're not particularly enhanced. So in fact, maybe I should just make that point a little clearer right now. So OK, so now we've got an expression. We should compare it to the one on the blackboard. So on the blackboard, I have a cross-section, which I told you could easily compute, although, well, it's an exercise for you. The integral dx1 dx2 of some expression that's written here. Now, we want to evaluate this for a configuration where the quark and the gluon are almost collinear, and the anti-quark is going in the other direction. So here's how you do that. Well, obviously, x1 is equal to 1 minus z. And x2 is going to be approximately equal to 1. And x3 is going to be approximately equal to z. So dx1, I can trade directly for dz. dx2, I have to work a little. So what you want to notice is that q minus k2 squared, which if you evaluate it is q squared times 1 minus x2, is also equal to k1 plus k3 squared, which is then equal to the p squared, which is, let's see, kt squared divided by z times 1 minus z. So what I claim is you can make the substitutions then. Dx1 is equal to dz, and dx2 over x2 is equal to dkt squared over kt squared. Okay. Sorry. Please excuse me. Dx2 divided by 1 minus x2. That's what I meant. Okay. So, yes?
How does 1 minus x2 give you something other than 0?
Well, it's not quite 1. And so this formula actually computes the distance it is from 1. Okay. So this is exactly equal to that. It's also exactly equal to this, which in our approximation is that. So I've computed the distance from 1. So the idea is that I have these two collinear things, which approximately split their momentum, and they recoil against something that's almost but not quite at the full energy. And the difference, if these guys were massless, it could be at the full energy. If there's any mass here, it can't quite be at the full energy. But it's very close to the full energy by a factor proportional to kt squared. OK, well, now let's just rewrite this formula. Sigma is equal to sigma over sigma 0 is equal to the integral dkt over kt, the integral dz. What's left is 1 plus 1 minus z squared divided by z times, there's a factor of 2 when I convert this to a kt, 4 thirds alpha s over pi. That's what I was missing. OK. So we can now completely understand the singularities of this formula from the collinear limit. And then if you want to consider wide-angle gluons, this formula takes into account all the wide-angle gluons. But the formula I wrote here is an approximation to that formula in the collinear limit. If you want to also compute for wide-angle gluons, as you might want to do to test, like to find alpha s, you probably want to count the wide-angle gluons. You want to use that formula. OK? Good. OK.
Not sensitive to this splitting.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes. OK. Well, now we've emitted one gluon. So now I guess the next thing. So as soon as I say that when you have a quark, the quark can emit a collinear gluon with high probability, this process is likely to be completely endemic in QCD. And so let me now gather some formulae. So this is our canonical formula. And, usually the 4/3 is in here in the definition. There's an integral over kt, which is a logarithmic integral. There's an integral over the splitting. There's got to be an alpha s over pi. And then there's some factor that determines what the longitudinal splitting is of the momentum. And I wrote down this factor. When a quark splits off a gluon, and the gluon carries momentum fraction z, that splitting function is this. Obviously, when a quark splits off a quark, it's just the same process looked at in the other way. So I should replace z by 1 minus z. So that's obviously equal to this. Now, there are two more cases. When a gluon splits into a QQ bar, so this is where the quark spits off a gluon. This is where the quark splits off a quark, and what's left over is a gluon. This is where the gluon splits to QQ bar. And this, it turns out, is a half z squared plus 1 minus z squared. And then the most complicated one, which maybe we can get Callum to derive for you in the tutorial, is where a gluon splits to a gluon. It's fun, actually. It's good practice, actually, with this 3-gluon vertex. And the answer there is 3 times 1 over z plus z to the 4th over z plus 1 minus z to the 4th over z. Sorry, times 1 minus z. And probably it's already clear to you that these are helicity states. This is where a left-handed gluon goes to 2 left-handed gluons. This is where a left-handed gluon goes to a leading left-handed gluon plus a right-handed gluon. And this is where the leading gluon is right-handed. And please notice again the suppression as z goes to 1. Yes?
I suppose that the function is p, g to q.
Okay. And these things are called the Alter-Alterisi split. Okay, every time you have a splitting, you also have a logarithmic enhancement. And you'll notice that several of these terms have 1 over z, so there are also these soft singularities. So sometimes you have a double logarithmic enhancement when you split off a soft thing. And then there's one more thing that I'd like to say about this, which is a little technical. But so for the details, if you're interested, look in my textbook. For when q goes to q, we have to not only add the quark that we created, but we have to subtract the quark that was omitted. So there's going to be a minus a times a delta function of z minus 1 and a minus b times a delta function of z minus 1 in this expression. And let's just say, if you look in my textbook, you'll see some way to treat these delta functions. OK. Things get really interesting. Because let's say we have a very, very hard e plus e minus to QQ bar reaction. So I start with a very large momentum transfer imparted to the quark and antiquark. Now the quark starts radiating a gluon. So here's the picture now. The quark radiates a gluon. The antiquark radiates a gluon. Let's not worry even about that side. The quark radiates another gluon. The gluon splits to 2 gluons. The quark radiates another gluon. The gluon turns into a QQ bar pair. The gluon radiates another gluon. Gradually, well, not even gradually, rapidly, we build up a lot of partons in this final state. And as we build up partons in the final state, they have some substantial transverse momentum. So what I'd like to do now is to try and organize this process. Every emission is proportional to alpha s over pi, which is a number which, as I said before, is somewhere between 0.1 and 0.2, times a logarithm of some energy scale, the kt max over the kt min. And if we start here with 100 GeV, and we go down to hadronic scales, 1 GeV here, this can be a large number. And so this can be an order 1 quantity. And so probably to really describe what's going on in the final state of E plus E minus, we'd better add all these things up. Now, fortunately, there's a nice way to do that. And so the the important thing to note is, let's think about the outgoing quarks successively radiating gluons. I'll call this Q1, Q2, Q3. So this momentum here is K plus Q3, and it's off shell by the transverse momentum of Q3. This gluon here is K plus Q2 plus Q3. So it's off shell by the collective transverse momentum of Q2 and Q3. Now, what I'd like you to notice is that if Q3 has a larger transverse momentum than Q2, that there's no special singularity here over the one that's here. But if Q3 has a smaller transverse momentum, then here we can ignore Q3, and then there's an extra logarithm here. And that keeps going. So we'll get, so if Q, the transverse momentum of Q3 is less than the transverse momentum of Q2 is less than the transverse momentum of Q1, and maybe keep going, then every time we add a gluon, we'll get another logarithm, and we'll get another enhanced quantity like that. So this kind of behavior is called, in QCD, strong ordering. And so these strongly ordered configurations have a definite structure. The hardest emissions, the ones with the largest, so the hardest in the sense of KT, the ones with the highest KT, occur closer to the root. And then as you go out, you have the softer and softer emissions. Softer and softer here means less and less KT away from the quark line. And finally, at the end of the day, everything is on shell. Well, of course, things don't really come on shell because we have to talk about quark confinement. But at least we can get within, let's say, a GeV of mass shell, or maybe half a GeV of mass shell, and then we go into the strong interaction, and then something happens, which we can even model as a black box, and then hadrons come out the other side. But because the largest KTs occur early, and of course the largest KT corresponds to a large momentum transfer, which means we're in the asymptotically free regime. That means we can actually predict the large momentum structure of the jet from QCD. So the largest KT tells us roughly how broad the jet is. And then the intermediate region of KT tells us how the jet is filled in with gluon. Okay, well now all we have to do is write the equation. And the equation is very simple. Well, there needs to be some room to write the equation. I'm going to erase this and refill it with the equation. So the way I'd like to think about it is this. I consider all this soft stuff happening up here. So then here I have a quark, and here at the back comes a quark with momentum equal to z times the momentum of that quark. So this is k0, and here I have k, and k is equal to z times k0 plus some transverse momentum. And so now I want to write the equation for the longitudinal, and then the probability to get this quark at z is going to be dz f, let me write q goes to q of z. And this will also depend on the hardness of these reactions. So let me write here q, where I only consider, I include kt less than q. Okay. Now what I'd like to do is add one more gluon. If I add one more gluon, then that gives me the log Yes.
Q
so F is defined by this expression. It is the probability that when I start with a quark here and integrate over all the emissions with kT less than Q, the final quark has momentum fraction z with respect to the original. Now, if I add another gluon, it comes with a d log kT and the other stuff that I had written on the blackboard. And so now I claim this function obeys the following differential equation. Df q to q d log q is equal to alpha s over pi times the integral dz of the splitting function for the original, the branching I'm adding, times the f. I'm going to have to worry a little about what the arguments are here. Let me fiddle with that in a moment. I'd just like to point out that since the emission involves a kT, which is a momentum transfer of order q, this should be evaluated at q. And finally, let's just fiddle with the arguments a little. What we have is that there's an integral dz, which is the z here, is equal to the integral, let me call this thing here w, just so I don't get confused. The integral dw, the integral dx, there's a p of w, there's an f of x, and what should happen is that the final z should be w times x, because I get the fraction w in this process, and then I get the fraction x in this process. So let's write this as the integral dz, z minus wx. And then if I integrate with the delta function here over x, I get the integral dw over w, the integral dz, p of w, f of z over w. And so that's what I should have actually written here. Okay? So now we'll integrate this from 0 to 1. And in every little slice of transverse momentum, I get a correction to this, we call it a jet function, which comes from the possibility of another gluon emission at that place. Okay? So now, well, it's clear that I could also consider this quark to have originated from a gluon splitting. So probably what I should do, actually, is to allow an arbitrary parton to be here. So P is now something that's summed over quarks, antiquarks, and gluons. And here, this should be true for any parton P1. And this should be true for any parton P3. Okay. And so this differential equation is called the Alterelli-Parisi equation. And what it tells us is that if we start out with a quark, the quark will then emit gluons. This whole branching process that I showed before will occur. I'll get a whole tree-like structure. And that tree-like structure is generated by integrating this equation. Okay. If alpha of s were constant, this would be a scale invariant structure, and the tree would be exactly a fractal. Because alpha of s runs, the tree is relatively sparse at the root, and it gets more filled in because the coupling gets stronger when you get out in the branches. So that's nice. The overall structure of the jet is determined at the root, and then the branches are filled in more and more densely. Eventually, that becomes a non-perturbative process. And then what we have to do is just model that based on low energy E plus E minus data. OK. So the F again is, if I start out with a quark here, or in general with a parton P2, and I let this process happen, and I include all momenta that involve kT less than Q, then F is the probability that the final quark, or in general parton P3, comes out with longitudinal momentum fraction Z. Okay. I think it has a proper name. It's called the fragmentation function. And this is called a parton shower. Yes. So, in fact, you can do something different here if you want to, which is that instead of just integrating this differential equation to try and find the momenta of individual partons, you could model these splittings as a Markov process and probabilistically create configurations, multi-parton configurations, based on these equations. And that thing is, as Callum said, called the parton shower. Yes?
Like, we're not forcing strong order, right?
So this equation, this equation only sums the strongly ordered diagram.
Okay.
There are corrections to this equation of relative order alpha s squared, of order alpha s squared, that would include, for example, a double splitting where these gluons either have about the same kT, and so the approximation is invalid, or they're in the wrong order, for which, again, the approximation is invalid.
But this is a close enough approximation?
Well, it depends how accurate you want to be. So when you model events, there are programs that implement these Markov chains. The names Pythia and Herwig may be familiar to some of you. So those basically use this equation. However, for a really accurate computation, people would include the next order as well. And if they could compute the order after that, they would include it. But no one actually knows how to do that. Okay. So now I guess I wanted to show you some more pictures. And so there's one more very impressive. So there are two more very impressive pictures I want to show you. So these are, I think, figures 7 and 8 of the figures. Pages 7 and 8 of the figures. Let's just, it's yesterday's. You should have it already. Go back one. That's page
7.
Yeah. On page 7, I just have some experimental plots for the three jet distributions. So the SLD measured in three jet events the x1, x2, and x3 distributions. And you see them plotted here. But, sorry, what's the problem? Oh, it's yesterday's lecture.
Oh.
Because we still haven't finished yesterday's lecture. I'm sorry. No, I just slipped by a day because, let me not go there. It's fine. We're learning things. So if you look in page 7 of the Tuesday figures, then what you'll see are experimental plots from the SLD experiment, remember at 91 GeV, of the quantities x1, x2, and x3 in three jet events. And for x3, it's particularly clear. You can see this shape. The lowest x parton in a three-jet event is typically the gluon. And you can see that that thing is falling off like 1 over x, and then it's a little enhanced even more at small values of x. So it traces more or less exactly the Altieri-Parisi splitting function for a quark to split a gluon. So I just wanted to show you that that's actually reflected in the data. Now, page 8 is a little more sophisticated, and it has to do with these markup processes. Because if I have, so now we've decided a typical E plus E minus event will have some structure like this. And now you've got to say, well, visually, you can tell what a jet is. And we could see that before that there were things that were obviously two-jet events, obviously three-jet events, and obviously four-jet events. But if we want to quantify what a jet is, that's another problem. Because do we consider this whole thing a jet, or do we consider this a jet? So here's one way to do that. We start off looking at the particles. We have some list of particles, I. We choose I and j such that pi plus pj squared mij is minimal over the final states of the event. We combine those into a single particle. We repeat this operation. So gradually, we're taking individual particles in pairs and combining them, the lowest mass pairs first. Typically, those will be the pairs that are collinear. Repeat until the mij squared is less than some m cutoff, and then stop. And when we stop, we define those effective particles to be the jet. So in a process like this, we'll combine, for example, these two, and these two, and these two, and these two, and then maybe these two, and then maybe these, and then maybe everything has too high a mass to combine it, so we would then call this a three-jet event. Okay? No, the cutoff is adjustable. Okay? Well, I'm going to show you the picture in a minute. So usually this is parameterized in terms of y cut is equal to m cut squared divided by the center of mass energy squared. And this can be anywhere from 1 to 10 to the minus 4. Okay? If the cutoff mass is 1 over 100, like if you're at 100 GeV or 200 GeV and you cut off at 2 GeV, that's a y cut of 10 to the minus 4. So if y cut is very large, everything is going to be organized into two jet events. If y cut is smaller, it'll reveal this fractal structure of the jet. Okay, so now please look at slide 8. So what you see there is the number of jets as a function of y cut recorded by the Opal experiment at 91 GeV. There's a comparison. The data is the data, and the lines are the solution of the Altieri-Parisi equations. Or rather, a markup chain model, a parton-Schauer model that implements the Altieri-Parisi equations. And very interestingly, you see exactly what I said. As you make the resolution finer, you reveal more and more of the structure of the jet. And you reveal the structural pieces come in exactly the way that's predicted by QCD. Yes?
What's going on with the three-jet data, 0.095?
What's happening is that when you start with a big Y cut, you get more and more three-jet events, because the two-jet events are turning into three-jet events. When you go down to a very small value of Y cut, the three-jet events turn into four-jet events. And so the three-jet rolls over, and the four-jet increases. And that'll happen for any number of jets as you go to sufficiently low y, provided that QCD were still working.
Okay.
provided we didn't get to the strong coupling. Okay.
Why was 921 GeV chosen for these?
Sorry?
Why was 921 GeV chosen for these plots?
Oh, because there's, as you remember from the R plot, there's a big resonance at 91 GeV. We're going to talk about that. Okay, that's it for today. And, okay, one more time.
So we build this idea to be able to count the number of jets.
Yes.
Where do we want to know the number of jets?
Well, roughly, each jet is a quark or a gluon. So up here, we were looking at three jet events to look for gluons. But now we realize we have to be a little more careful. The jet depends on exactly how you define it. And so if you want to predict the number of gluons that you see in QCD, you should do a computation that's aware of these subtleties, and then also an experimental analysis that uses or does the subtleties in the same way. So you just have to be careful when you compare experiments with QCD theory, because it's and we will see more of that tomorrow. Okay. Thank you.